John 20. I want to continue our walk through Matthew by going to John again. We're going through the last step after the resurrection. I won't go back over what I've covered because I wouldn't make any progress if I did. But Jesus has met with the 10 of the disciples and has addressed them, has spoken to them. And in that meeting, Thomas was not there. Let's look in verse 25, just sort of get our thoughts back in gear. Thomas wasn't there when Jesus came, but after he left, Thomas came in verse 25. The other disciples therefore said unto him, Thomas, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I see in his hands the prints of the nails, and put my finger into the prints of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. He's simply saying, I must see to believe. That's about how we are nowadays. It shows our lack of faith. No doubt Thomas was a man who dealt with and battled with fear and doubt. But the other disciples did also, as I mentioned last week. And then we go to the step 13. If you look in John chapter 20, verse 26, and after 8 days, again, his disciples were within in a room, and Thomas with them. So he came to church that night. This, of course, 8 days being Sunday again. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, peace be unto you. Then saith he to Thomas, reach hither thy finger and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but believing. Jesus comes. Notice what he says again, peace be unto you. His desire was that his disciples have peace in a troublesome time. He wanted them. By the way, he wants the same thing for us. We're living in troublesome days. There's no doubt about that. But our Lord wants us to have peace. He wants us to experience the peace that he had. And I believe we can. But Thomas was there this time, and Jesus addresses him almost immediately, it seemed like, from our text. So he addresses Thomas, and he says to do exactly what Thomas said he would have to be able to do. He says, reach here your finger and behold my hands and touch my hands and reach in here and touch my side. He is offering exactly what Thomas demanded. I wonder, did he hold his hands out? I have no idea. We aren't told, but I sort of picture that. As he is talking to Thomas, he offers him to be able to look. He's not just saying a bunch of words, but he really means what he says. But he says here, be not faithless, but believing. Be not faithless. In other words, do not doubt. Do not fear. I said it already. He is addressing Thomas's problem. I'm glad God does that. He doesn't beat around the bush. He doesn't just sort of tiptoe around to the edges. He goes straight to the knees, straight to the problem. Sometimes that hurts. But we must be dealt with. We must be confronted. And so he saw the need for Thomas. So he deals exactly and directly with his flaw. And his problem was his doubt. God doesn't play around with doubt. Doubt grieves him. It is one of our greatest enemies. Now, here has Thomas been for a week in agony, worried, troubled, fearful, and he didn't even have to be. Jesus had risen, and there's no doubt about that, but he has been in turmoil for a week longer than the other disciples because of his lack of belief. Our doubt hurts our Father. It stifles the spirit, and it cripples the Christian. And there's no wonder the devil tries to use this against us. He wants us to doubt. He wants us to be fearful. But Jesus said, first he said, don't be faithless. But then he said, believe. In other words, he says, this is what you don't do, but this is what you do do. You don't doubt, but you believe. The way we conquer doubt is by believing. Isn't that simple? Don't you wish I'd said that a lot earlier so you could not had all this trouble with doubt like I do so many times? He said, believe. Trust me. Here's what he's saying. Believe what you have heard. The disciples told you they saw me. By the way, I told you I was going to rise from the dead. Instead of worrying about what you're seeing, says Jesus to Thomas, believe what you have heard from the ones who tell you the truth. God tells us the truth, and we can believe. We do not have to doubt when it comes to what God has said. That is the basis of our belief, if we're believing the right thing. It is a basis that is sure, a foundation that is secure. What God said, we can believe no matter what we're seeing, no matter what we're thinking. We can believe it with no doubt, and that's what Jesus said to Thomas. Stop being faithless and start being a man of faith. I have to say this before I move on. I sure do see an extraordinary mercy in this conversation. I mean, I'll be honest, I'd have let Thomas have it just like I said last time. I'd have let the disciples have it. But then I think about me, and I sure do want mercy on me when I'm doubting and fearful. And here we find Jesus being very merciful to a man who did not deserve it. And by the way, that's what mercy is. Look in verse 28. Thomas answered and said unto him, my Lord and my God. I don't think he had the feel of the wounds. He maybe did. I don't know, but I don't think he had to. I think just seeing Jesus and hearing the words and the authority Jesus had, and he's there, he's alive. Notice what he said, my Lord and my God, shows there that Jesus is God. He's not just the Son of God, a step down from God, the offspring of God, but he is very God. Look in verse 29. Jesus saith unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. And that's not real bad. I mean, he is now believing. He is believing because he saw, but at least he is believing. When Thomas saw Jesus, it thrilled him. He said, my Lord and my God. And I believe he said it with an excitement that I didn't have. My example of his excitement fell far short. So he was, it says, blessed, happy are you because you've seen and you have believed. But he goes further. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed. He said those that are really blessed are those who do not have to see before they believe. Those who believe because of what God said. Here's Thomas. He's happy now. Could have used those words because he was. But he could have been happy all week long had he just believed the word. Had he heard, believed the truth, he wouldn't have had to spend this week of misery and fear. Jesus said, you're happy now because you saw and believed, but you could have been happy and happier by just believing. We need to realize the importance of not having to see before we believe. We believe and then we see. Faith brings the things to reality. I wonder how much grief have we experienced? How much turmoil do we go through? How many restless days and nights of fear do we experience when we don't have to for our lack of faith that so many times consumes us? I do know this, Thomas's doubt grieved God, because the Bible says, without faith you cannot please God, which means our lack of faith displeases him or hurts him or grieves him. And so we need to believe just like the disciples. We need to believe just like Jesus said. I said, you know, move on. Our faith is based on what God said, and what God says is always true. No matter what we see, feel, hear, or think about, We can believe what God said. There's no room, no need for doubt. And I'm glad that we can trust Him. Now, I'm glad Jesus wasn't content in leaving Thomas where he was. He could have just ignored Thomas and not dealt with his issue, but he wanted Thomas to go further. He wanted him to believe, and I'm glad he does the same thing to us. He is not content with us where we are spiritually. He is trying to draw us out and help us grow and help us develop. I rejoice in that. Then in step 14, there's some times when Jesus met with the disciples and the different people. And we really do not know exactly, but in John 21, the first 25 verses, Matthew again, we are still in Matthew, believe it or not. And this is another one of the things that Matthew does not record. So I want to go through it. I think it's too good to ignore or not deal with. In this experience in John 21, those first 25 verses, Jesus meets with seven disciples. And we're going to find out they're fishing. This is the third time, verse 14 tells us, that Jesus has met with these disciples. He met with them as the 10, and he met with them as the 7, or the 10 when Thomas was without him. And he met him with 10 without Thomas, met him with the 11 when Thomas was there. And now this occasion, this is the third time that he met the disciples after his resurrection with them collectively. Look at verse 1. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise showed he himself. The Sea of Tiberias is, of course, the Sea of Galilee. He told them, remember, to meet him at Galilee. And I have thought, why in the world did he tell them to go to Galilee? Galilee is about 70 miles north of Jerusalem. Well, it's a long way to ride a donkey or to walk. It's not just an afternoon drive. It's a long way to walk. And on top of that, when he met them at Galilee, one of the things he told them to do was go back to Jerusalem. So why in the world take them all the way up to Galilee? Well, I got a few things that I believe that's the reason. I believe that he wanted them away from all the drama going around Jerusalem. All the danger. See, the Jews are still around Jerusalem. And all that religious bunch, by the way, remind you, that's the ones that put Jesus to death. They're still in an uproar, and they're still looking for those disciples of that hypocrite, that Jesus man. So I believe one thing, Jesus got them out away from that for a little while at least, to sort of relieve them of their fear and all the tension and all the drama, and a place where there's less danger. I believe also he said go to Galilee because that's where they were from. It was as though he says, why don't y'all just go home for a while and get some familiar surroundings, and I'll meet you there. There's no place like home. Dorothy's not the only one that thinks that. And I believe one of the reasons why he sent them to Galilee was because it was, as for the most part, a home setting for them. And I believe that Jesus knew they needed that home, if you will, hometown comfort to relieve them and give them some security and ease their fear and uncertainty. I believe also another reason why he sent them to Galilee is because that's where he had done a lot of miracles. And maybe they're walking down the road and they say, hey, remember that blind man that was right over there? And Jesus healed him. Remember that leper there, that house? Boy, and Jesus cleansed him. What about that woman right over there? They walk by those places where Jesus had done miracles. And as they're walking and remembering those miracles and those wonderful things, and maybe that's where he preached that message where, oh, he touched my heart and God help me. And they're in that familiar place, and those memories are coming back, and it's helping their faith and increasing their vitality for the Lord. So I think that's one of the reasons why Jesus sent them back to Galilee. But also, Galilee was a place Could I say it like this? It's kind of like Hawkeye. It's on the other side of the tracks. The common folks live there. The Jerry Springer people live there. There's not a whole lot of dignity there. In other words, that's the common folks. And he's sending them, he's about to send them out to some common folks, ordinary people. He's going to send them throughout the land, and most of the people who will hear them are common folks. So he's getting them used to the settings. Getting them used to the setting of where they're sending, he's going to be sending them. Now notice in verse 2, and there were together Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee and the sons of Zebedee and two other of his disciples. Well, count that. There's seven. Got a question. Where's the other four? He said to all the disciples, he told Mary, tell them to come. He told the disciples, I'll meet you in Galilee. And they're in Galilee, but there aren't but seven. What happened to the other four? We don't know. But I do know this, they should have been there and they weren't. And since they weren't, they missed what God is about to do in this miracle we're about to see. So they miss the opportunity of seeing something good. But Jesus is about to use this experience as an object lesson. Remember, he has already told them, I'm going to make you fishers of men. And he's about to use what happens in this place of Galilee, on the Sea of Galilee, as an object lesson. Look in verse 3. Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. They say unto him, we also go with thee. They went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. Well, good old Peter, he's always the one that says something first, whether it's right or wrong. And he says to them, they're at the Sea of Galilee. Now, they're to meet him in Galilee on a mountain. We don't know exactly when Jesus told them which mountain to go to, so I'll give them a little bit of leeway here. They're in Galilee, which is the right place for the most part. And they undoubtedly are close enough to the Sea of Galilee that it makes Peter think about, well, what about going fishing? There's a whole lot of ink that has been spilled about Peter's comment, I go a-fishing. Some people say, because it does have, it is a tense in the Greek that means continual. In other words, I am going fishing. As though I'm going back to my old profession. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. He could say, I am going to go fishing. So to be honest, if you're a preacher, you can preach it any other way. Either way, I should say. Whether he was out of God's will or in God's will about fishing. Was he saying, I am through with this discipleship thing. I'm going back to my old profession. Or was he just simply saying, well, we're waiting for Jesus. We're not doing anything. Why don't we go fishing? We really do not know. And to be honest, you can look at it either way. But I lean toward he's just occupying time. And I have a couple of reasons for that. One thing for sure, it is possible that Peter said, I have made such a mess at being a disciple of Christ. I cannot do it. I'm going to go back to the one thing I can do. I used to be a good fisherman. This discipleship stuff, this following Christ, I have failed, and I have made a mess. I'm going to go back to the one thing I can do well. I'm going to go back to fishing. He could have meant that. But if he did, Jesus is going to teach him, hey, without me, you can't even fish. Because he didn't catch a thing that night. But I believe Peter is just saying, we're here, and we're waiting on him, and we don't know when he's coming. So while we're waiting, let's do something productive. Let's go fishing. We can have something to eat. We can go and sell the fish that's extra, and have some money to spend. By the way, it does take money to live. And I lean in that direction that that's what he was doing, which indicates it wasn't bad, wasn't wrong. So he says, I'm going to go fishing. And like always, when one person does something, there's usually someone close that's going to follow that example. Peter said, I go fishing, and they say, we go also with thee. So the other disciples, remember, Andrew and James and John, they were fishermen before Jesus said, follow me also. So we got some fishermen in the bunch. And for them to say, hey, if you're going to go fishing, we're going to go with you. So the seven disciples go fishing, and they fish all night, which was the right time and in the right place. The Sea of Galilee, there was an abundance of fish. And they did everything they knew to do. And used every trick they knew, seasoned, expert fishermen, and they caught nothing. I want to tell you something, that was a miracle. God performed a miracle by not letting them catch anything. I mean, listen, to use a net all night long and not catch one fish was unheard of, especially with seasoned fishermen. The same God that can draw the fish into the net can keep the fish away from the net. And that's what he did that night. They toiled all night and caught nothing. Could I just throw this in or go on? We can do the best we can in our work for the Lord and accomplish nothing if we do it in our own flesh and our own ability. We are insufficient in our self-effort. All we can do is useless, and our labor will be vain if we don't have his help and his touch. Verse 4, but when the morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not it was Jesus. They fished all night. Morning's coming. And on the shore, there's a man. And we'll find out in just a second, they didn't. Well, it said there in that verse that they didn't know who it was. Now, we don't know if their eyes were restrained like other meetings after the resurrection and their eyesight was withheld, or if it's just that the sun was just barely coming up and they couldn't see, couldn't recognize who he was. They were only about 100 yards away. That's what one of the verses says later on in this verse 8. But even 100 yards away, if the sun's just barely coming up or the sun's behind you, we don't know. All we know is that he was there and they did not know who he was. Verse 5, then Jesus said unto them, children, have ye any meat? And the stranger calls to them from the shore and says, do you have any meat? The meat there literally means any portion. The smallest, do you have a tidbit? Do you have a crumb? It literally means, do you have even a sauce? It means, do you have anything? And they answered him, no. What a short answer. But they weren't about to try to explain it away. They gave the answer that they only could answer, a sad response, a pitiful thing. Jesus made them admit their failure. But it's better to admit our failure than to deny it. It's better to admit that I have failed miserably than to try and explain it away or deny. They had no response they could offer up other than no. Verse 6, and he said unto them, cast a net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. And they cast therefore. And now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. He's still on the shore. And he said, cast a net on the right side, and if you cast it on the right side, you'll catch a multitude of fish. Well, what a strange command. Did he think they had not tried the other side of the boat? Did he think they had not rowed around everywhere on that sea almost and tried every spot they could? I mean, their surefire spots where always there were fish didn't work that night. But he says, cast the net on the right side of the boat. What a strange command. But they did it. in the same place they'd been fishing all night. And he said, if you'll do what I say, you'll catch fish. You know what that is? That's a promise. God said, do this and you will accomplish. This will be accomplished. This will happen. That means God spoke and he never forgets his promises. The key to his instructions was what he said. If they will do what he said, they will get what he said. And that's exactly the truth of our lives. And when they did what he said, they caught a multitude of fish that were so big they could not even pull the net in. They couldn't even get the net pulled into the boat in the very same place they'd been fishing all night. And strange, but listen, at this time, they still didn't even know it was Jesus. And I've wondered, why did they listen to the command, the instruction of a stranger? And I'm sort of committed to the fact that he just spoke with an authority, that there was just inside them an urge to do it. And sometimes that's how the Holy Spirit does. There's just an urge. There's just I don't like this word, but I say it, a feeling, a drawing, a pushing, a prodding. That's why we need to be very sensitive to the Lord. And he said, cast the net. Do it the same way. He did not tell them to do it some other way. He didn't say, you've been using the wrong method all night. I got an updated plan. I got something new and improved. No, he said, do the same thing you've been doing, but with my blessing, following my instruction, you'll be blessed. Can I just say it? We don't need a new plan. We don't need a new method. God's word, if God's word doesn't work, if God's method doesn't work, we just, well, forget it. But it will if we do it his way, if we obey the Lord. Look at verse 7. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved saith unto Peter. Now, we know that disciple that Jesus loved to be John. And he says to Peter, it is the Lord. John recognized it was Jesus. Now, we don't know how, maybe just the fact that, hey, here's a multitude, here's a catch that's miraculous. How was somebody else that did that before? And he says, that's got to be Jesus. Or maybe his eyes were open, or the sun got up a little bit brighter. We don't know, but we do know this. John knew it was Jesus, and he told Peter, it is the Lord. Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girded his fisherman's coat unto him, for he was naked, and had cast himself into the sea. John recognized the stranger and told Peter who it was. And Peter didn't wait. He put on his outer garment. Now, the word naked there does not mean completely nude. That word is used several times. I'll put it in your notes when I get them to you. Several times in the Bible where it talks about the outer garments removed. And Peter had removed his coat, his outer garment, to make fishing easier. But when he knew it was Jesus, he put that coat back on, that outer garment, and jumped into the water because he's heading to Jesus. That's one of the reasons why I think his fishing was okay with the Lord. Now, he could have said, well, last time I got in trouble with the Lord, I ran away from him, and now I'm in trouble now, so I'm going to run toward him. That could be, but I don't think it is. I believe that Peter's been wanting to see Jesus so much. And this fishing is just something to sort of fill in the time. Now Jesus is here, and he's not going to wait to get out of the bigger boat into the smaller boat and row to shore. He jumps in and heads to shore as fast as he can. He wants to see Jesus as soon as he can. I believe that indicates that he was okay to go fishing, and he was in the Lord's will. But he ran to the Lord as fast as he could. We do well to learn to get to Jesus as soon as we can. When we're in need or just any time. Notice, he put his outer garment on. He wanted to make sure he was presentable before he went to Jesus. I think that tells us something. Our attire does matter. Our appearance does matter. God told Moses, you're on holy ground. You take your shoes off. There's a certain way to approach God. And I believe this addresses that. And we recognize that. Verse 8. Let me say this. Peter jumps out of the boat and leaves the boat behind and the fish. He forgets about the disciples. He forgets about the fish. And he says, there's something more important than fish or disciples. And heads to Jesus. Verse 8, and the other disciples came in a little ship. They got off the fishing boat on a little ship that could make it to shore, for they were not far from the land. It was about 200 cubits, about 100 yards, dragging the net of fishes. They couldn't get the net of fishes into the boat, so they just rowed to shore, dragging the thing behind them. They wouldn't let go of the miracle that God had done. Thank the Lord for that. There's a message there. Verse 9. As soon then as they were come to land, they saw a fire of coals there and fish laid up thereupon and bread. Jesus, instead of rebuking them, said, fellas, got breakfast fixed for you. And there's again a miracle. I don't believe he started the fire with the two sticks rubbing together and went out and caught fish and went and fixed some bread and baked it and brought it. I believe there's another miracle involved there with the bread and the fish. Look at verse 10. And Jesus said to them, bring of the fish which you have now caught. So he has fish of his own. But he said, of this multitude of fish you caught, I want you to bring me some. I think that's another indicator that Peter's fishing and the disciples' fishing was okay. If it wasn't, I don't think Jesus would have anything to do with it. Now, there's some more comments I could make about that, but I won't. I'll just confuse you more and take up time I don't have. But he says, bring some of the fish that you've brought. Verse 11, Simon Peter went up and drew the net to the land full of great fishes. So Simon Peter went out there and drug the net up to the shore to where he could get the fish. And 153, so there was 153 great fishes in the net. And for all there were so many, that yet was not the net broken. There's a whole lot of discussion about 153. Some people have said there's 153 different species of fish in the Sea of Galilee, and that represents everybody in the world, and they're supposed to go to be fishers of men of everybody in the world, and that sounds real great, except for one thing. There ain't 153 species of fish in the Sea of Galilee. You want to know why there's 153 fish in that net? You want to know? I don't know, and neither does anybody else. And I don't know why he told us, except for us to be interested on a Wednesday night. I do know this, he knew every one of them. He didn't miss one. Maybe that's just by itself enough. That net would have weighed about 300 pounds, by the way, and the net didn't break. Another miracle. The net should have broken. Hey, listen. It didn't. I'll mention that in just a second. Verse 12, I'm getting closer to getting done, but I want to get this tonight. So just kind of hang on to your seat. Verse 12, Jesus said to them, come and dine. And none of the disciples just asked him, who art thou, knowing that it was the Lord? He said, come on, eat breakfast. Time to eat. And it said, none of the disciples just asked him, who art thou? The word ask means to interrogate. In other words, nobody came this time and saying, is it really you? Show me some proof that it's you. Nobody had to do that because they know it's him. Their doubt is gone, and they know it's him. Their doubt has disappeared. Verse 13, Jesus then cometh and break and taketh bread and give it to them, and the fish likewise. This now is the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after that he was risen from the dead. Now, I know you wish I was through, but I got some points to ponder. It's too good to go through these verses without some points to ponder. I got too many to do with them tonight, so I'm going to do with them anyway. Let's listen real quick, and I'll talk real quick. What do we find in these verses about this miraculous catch? We dare not miss the lessons that Jesus is trying to teach us. Number one, God uses the circumstances of our life to teach us great truths. Here's a fishing trip, and Jesus taught these disciples and us some great truths. The reason we go through what we go through every day of our lives is God's trying to teach us through our circumstances some great truths, some lessons that we can learn. Those problems, those troubles, those triumphs, those mountains, those valleys, everything we go through, God is trying to use us to teach, and use those circumstances to teach us something. Jesus has said, I'm going to make you fishers of men. And he proved to them, you cannot catch men without me. You can work all night like you did, do everything you know to do, and you'll be unsuccessful without my touch. The second thing, doing the will of God is vitally important. They tried their way and failed. But when they did it His way, they were successful. Listen to God and do it His way. Listen to God and do it His way. He always blesses His way. If we do it His way, we can count on blessings. Doing it His way is vitally important. The next thing, trying to work on our own will produce nothing. All their effort, and I'm telling you, I believe they put everything they had into that night of work all night long and caught nothing. And all of our self-effort will produce nothing. The next thing, when we do it in God's way, He will bless our effort. They cast the net in just like they had done probably 1,000 times before, but they did it at His bidding, and they caught fish. God will bless His way when we put forth the effort and obey Him. After following His command, they were blessed. The next thing, Jesus knows where the fish are. He told them exactly where to drop the net because He knew that's where fish were. And Jesus knows the fish that we ought to go searching for them. When He puts somebody on your heart, you better pray for them. When He touches your heart and say, give a tract to that person, there's a reason for it. I believe He touches both sides, us to reach out and them to receive. He knows where the fish are. We need to listen to Him and follow His direction as we're fishing for men in this world. He touches us and He touches them. The next thing, He will protect that which He provides. The net didn't break. It not only caught the fish, it held the fish. The salvation that caught us is strong enough to hold us. Could I go further? The ministry He puts us in, the fishing of men, He can take care of that ministry. He can hold it together. It is His ministry. It is His church. It is His singing. It is His preaching. It is His teaching. It is His life. If we'll just trust Him, He protects that which He provides. The next thing, God always gives the best. The fish He had on the fire and the fish they caught were two different kinds of fish. The Greek word of the fish on the fire He fixed were small fish. You can read in the verse, it was great fish or large fish they caught. Now we'd say, man, I want the big one. But it's very clear, it's proven that the small fish in the Sea of Galilee were the best tasting. They were delicacies. God always gives the best. If we'll trust Him to give us what we need, He will always give us the best. The next thing, by following His instructions, the disciples caught more than Jesus had. I don't know how many fish was on Jesus' fire, but I do know this, there wasn't 153. They caught more than He had. Now, I don't mean by that He caught them literally, but they had more than He had. What did Jesus say? If you'll follow me, you'll do things greater than I have. And they're already seeing this. God is using them greater than what Jesus is doing. My, 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 what we could see in our day if we would follow the Lord. The next thing, God blesses the effort of His people. He didn't say, just sit right there and I'll catch you some fish. No, He said, you put the net in again. You cast it. And then they had to pull the net to shore. So they had to put forth the effort. They had to obey the instruction. But in obeying the instruction and doing what He's saying, God blessed it. And surely it's not my work and not my effort that gets the job done. But I do need to be willing to put forth the effort and to I can sit on the front pew and say, I ain't preaching this morning. I'm just going to trust God to say what needs to be said. And some of you probably would be glad for that. Or I can get up and preach, cast the net, and God will do it. So it's our effort, not our self-effort, but His following His instructions. He does bless the effort of His people. The nets and the boat were needed, and the nets had to be cast in. The people had to do it. And then lastly, I was listening for that word too. God uses man to accomplish His will. God used those men to accomplish what he wanted done. All self-effort accomplished nothing. But they did, as I've already said, it involved effort. The net and the boat were valuable, but they were useless without God's touch, but they were needed when God did touch. Again, our techniques without power will be powerless and useless. There's no room in God's family for laziness. He said to those tired disciples, do it one more time. And when they did, they were blessed. Well, thank you for listening. Let's stand together.